Thank you. We also have a phrase in Syracuse as a three-time Syracuse grad, we bleed orange, which leads me to believe if ever I was driving with an alum of Hamilton and we got in a horrible car accident, we would actually have SU colors. So, so I normally get up and do these wonderful little Baptist preacher things, and I will not promise that that won't happen again tonight, but it's also a small enough group that I hope that we can be interactive. So when I say something completely stupid, and I will, feel free to, you know, call me on it and we can have a conversation. The other thing I should warn you about is that I go a little manic around so many blackboards because I love them. So the joke, and my wife allows me to continue to tell this joke, is that she's Italian and speaks with her hands. I'm an academic. I speak with a chalkboard. So anyway, who knows if that will turn into chalk talk, as it were. So I want to talk about today some changes that I see going on in higher education, or rather some changes I think need to happen in higher education in general. And I want to tell you why I believe that libraries and the way we look and re-envision and reimagine libraries actually suit us very well to think about how we can reimagine and rethink about higher education. To give you a little bit of context, David mentioned the MOOC. There is the MOOC. We really need to work on our acronyms. I think that the open source community is only the second worst at acronyms, but MOOC. Anyway, did you hear about it? Harvard has decided that they're moving away from the MOOC. They're moving to SMOOCs. Small, I don't know what the M, but it's like small private online classes. And like I said, oh, like we've been doing for, 30 years in online education, but Harvard discovered it, so it's new and important now. Anyway, I can make fun of Harvard here, can't I? All right. So that gives you a sense of some general statistics we had about, do we need to worry about the mic? Are we okay? It's my cell phone. All right. So we need to worry about, I'll just hit the button. It'll be fine. We had about 3,000 people say, ooh, that sounds great, and about 2,400 people decide to actually enroll in the course. I've now officially taught more people in one course than I taught for the rest of my career. So that was very interesting. We had about 281 that actually finished it. This is not apparently a remarkable statistic in the MOOC world, about a 10% completion rate, sort of what you expect. We had one person take it for graduate credit. That's right. They had a choice of doing it for free or doing it for $3,500, and they plunked down the money. That's a model that's sustainable. And we'll talk about that in a moment, too. And we had about 20 of them take for continuing education units, which was only $150. And those were primarily school librarians, some public librarians that need recertification. They were able to then get those CEUs. But we did this as an experiment. The experiment, because this is the second one that the iSchool had done. The first MOOC that we had done was on data sciences. And we've just started a data sciences certificate advanced studies. This is the idea we're drowning in, millions and millions of bits of data. Can we make sense of it? Can we mine it? These kinds of things. And each of these experiments was for a slightly different reason. Both of them were the idea of continuing education. How can we reach out and continue to engage the profession, where I'm from a professional school. Part of it was reputation building, let's face it. Part of it was looking at the technology, and part of it was different business models. So the business models of the data mining course were, can we sort of get people hooked and then get them to take the CAS? Right? So can we give it away for free and then have them pay those $3,500 a semester to come take the courses? Mine was a slightly different business model, which is still about continuing education, still experimenting with the platform, but we wanted to see about continuing education. Was there a way to engage people so that after they're in the field, they come back? And once again, I think the data shows, yeah, they'll come back, but don't expect them to bring their checkbook with them. So I want to make to you a proposition in three parts. The first part is I want to talk about the looming apocalypse for higher education, because I believe that overstatement can never be overstated. The second is I want to talk a little bit about the transformation in libraries, and then I want to put those threads together and talk about how that transformation in libraries actually indicates a potential transformation in higher education. So let's start with the fun, and I have to show you my new favorite picture. This is the 404 page. Right? The 404 page is in web land. If you ask for a page it doesn't have, a file not found, it sends a 404 error. And so this is the University of Dallas. The page you are looking for does not exist, or does it? According to Kant, there are fundamental features of reality that escape our indirect... And that's brilliant. Isn't that great? Anyway, so here are the major issues that I look at that I say higher education as currently constructed in the U.S. is in trouble. This is an interesting data graph. This talks about the percentage of the populations in different countries and their academic achievement. This indicates the number of people who've gotten a high school diploma. Right? So you'll see that the age group, green diamonds are from 25 to 34, red squares are from 45 to 54. So we're looking at generational, right? Parents and children. And what you'll notice is that certain places like Mexico, not doing so well, Korea, doing really great. But the other thing is you'll notice the distance between them indicates something, which is looking at generational shift. So not only is Korea doing very well, but it did really well within a generation. It dramatically increased this completion rate. Now, if you look at that data, one data point stands out. Right? It's the only data point on there that flipped. And it's not a huge flip, but it's a flip. Where what that's saying is in the U.S., the current generation is getting fewer high school diplomas than the previous one. And this is in the era of we're moving in an information age. We all need to have college degrees. We all need to go and get these higher education. We're having trouble keeping up with high school degrees. Lots of different reasons for it. I'm not going to go into the idea of the diaspora and problems, but it indicates that there's an issue going on in education. This issue is matched by what I think is an even more significant issue, which is this chart. This chart is what it costs to get by in the world. And what you will notice is in our discussions of Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act and everything about medical income and medical costs going up and up and up, and it's obscene, notice that it pales in comparison to college tuition and fees. We have a situation where we are looking at a massive inflation in the cost of higher ed. Now, we can see lots of different reasons for it. First of all, the pool is widening that we're pulling from, but we also see a pretty major infusion of cheap money into the market through government funding, through subsidies. We see this idea of a relatively painless investment. And I say painless because up until this point, the argument and the data bears out, if you get the degree, you'll get the money back. People with a college degree, you ever see the one, the graph that shows degree by income, right? So, you know, high school degree, you're at this income, you get a bachelor's degree, you go to this one, you get a master's, you go to this one, you get a PhD, you go back down here. Right? But it's now getting to the point where that's not necessarily happening. And if you're a dean of a law school these days, you've been told very clearly that you're having problems keeping up with these statistics. So we have a situation where if we haven't yet hit the point of pain, we are nearing the point of pain. This is why we have a recurrent national discussion about things like assessment in higher education, the report card in higher education. How can I know if I'm a parent shopping for my son or daughter that they are going to, in essence, get a job and earn this money back? Now, I'm saying this in Hamilton College, in a liberal arts college, where the discussion between, but is that why they're going to college? Is it for an education? Is it for a job? I understand that that's a debate. I come from a professional school where we're not allowed to have that debate. The answer is, that's okay. Think about it. So, yeah. All right. So this is something that is becoming increasingly for an academic professional an ethical question. The ethics of having people invest that to what they're going to get back. We are now putting people into debt. We're now putting people into debt for decades. When they're looking at med students and law students graduating in hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt, you go, well, they're doctors and lawyers. Well, the lawyer part doesn't hold up so well anymore. And what are we talking about for other careers and individuals? But that's not the beginning of the apocalypse. This will kill us, right? By the way, if you haven't seen The Library of the Living Dead, it's a graphic novel. That's the URL. It'll be online. It's a graphic novel they use for orientation for their students. It is brilliant. It is brilliant. Anyway, scholarly publishing, right? We're in the midst of really looking around and saying, does it make sense for our faculty to give away their intellectual efforts so that our libraries can buy them back at increasing prices? Right? We're going to be bankrupted by our idea that we have, you know, giving everything to Elsevier and who do we have to pay and all this other stuff, right? This is not a minor issue. And when we look at open access is not a solved solution. I think it's a great solution. I think it's one that we need to develop. But there are some issues like, you know, what do they accept and what they won't accept and these kinds of things that we have to deal with. How do we pay for peer review? How do we bring that quality in? Passing of the baby boom echo. The fact is, the baby boomers came and we built lots of buildings. It's 1972 when you built the library was for a reason, which is those baby boomers got busy. Okay. And now we're having, well actually, no, their parents did. But anyway, now, they're going down. So our pool of potential people that we can pull from is problematic. It's even more problematic when you become, say, a medium-sized research university in upstate New York when you look at the population as a whole is decreasing and suddenly you talk about areas of opportunity, meaning that we're going to go poach everyone from Denver, right? Because people in Denver desperately want to come to Syracuse to get their degrees. The skiing's great, if you can get them. Well, anyway, so that's a big problem we have. We also have the problem of for-profit. Now, what's interesting is for-profits, if you remember the days of Phoenix, this was going to kill us all. And what happened is, what's really interesting, when I look at for-profits is, they got into the exact same business as the not-for-profits. In other words, what did they glom onto? The same federal, low-cost money to pull in the tuition, the same business model, so they didn't really rock the boat too much. Yes, tenured faculty weren't thrilled that they didn't have tenure systems and all these other things. Hey, who has tenure systems at work anymore? Anyway, and so we have this situation where the threat of what's the next disruption, what are we going to do? And now we look at MOOCs. And so MOOCs, massively open online courses, is the idea that we can give away our education for free. Not ironically started by very large institutions with very, very large endowments that can give away things for free. And the idea was, what happens if we open up a course to thousands of people? Now I get 2,500. Ooh, ah. Jeff Pomerantz, who's teaching through Coursera, has something like 30,000 taking a metadata course. Your librarians, you know metadata. At some point, did you have a question? Now imagine that you're in a pool of 30,000 people and you do this. Does that work or not? How do we do that? Now, what people don't often understand is that MOOCs didn't start as, let's take that boring guy in front who's lecturing like this, videotape him, and put it online. They actually started around something called the connectivist MOOCs. They started by people saying, this is not the best education system. We want to get people talking and sharing and posting blogs and posting information and connecting and doing very constructivist pedagogy stuff. But Coursera and the disruption is the idea of how can we take this and move it. And there have been some rough spots, the two rough spots, my favorite rough spots. One, when San Jose State University, their philosophy department, was sort of instructed to use the Coursera lecture on, social justice, right? As lectured by a Harvard University professor to a bunch of white guys, they were going to teach social justice by taking this course and putting it in San Jose. And the philosophy department said, I don't think so. The other one, which I thought was even better, was someone was teaching a course, a professor was teaching a course on group dynamics and education, and he decided halfway through that he was done and quit the course, and they kept offering the course without him. Now, we've all been in a lecture or two where, frankly, the faculty member was irrelevant to the process, but it doesn't bring something up. So the thing with MOOCs is people are talking about, well, this is a major disruption time. This is the time that we should look at whole new models of higher education. That what happens if we give it away for free? Why are we building big buildings? Why are we doing these massive physical investments? Why do we have tenure systems? Why do we have this? Right, the MOOC one is very interesting because when we talk about the future of higher education, what they've done is they have reduced the work of a university down to a very singular function, which is teaching. Now, it's an important function, mind you, but it is not an exclusive function. I heard a great, and this was not a sarcastic comment, made at a lecture in Oxford. They said, one of the great things that a university does is they can sustain an argument over a long period of time, like generations. Right? For thousands of years, we've been asking the question of why are we here and what is the meaning of life and truth? Can we afford to do that if we're profit-driven or if we're doing these things? So there's a lot that goes on to a university. If we're going to talk about how do we change the teaching part of it, that's fine. But what do we do with the rest of it? And worse, what we're really talking about is taking a rather outdated model of teaching and putting that online. Right? We know that people learn best when they're doing something and building something, not sitting and listening to people. You're welcome, right? And so what are we doing? Well, now we're talking to 2,500 people by having them sit there. Someone once talked about flipping the classroom, the idea that people do their sort of lecturing at home and then they come in and they do activities. And someone said, flipping the classroom does not mean lecturing to people in their bedrooms, right? We have to figure out, how do we get in, how do we teach, how do we get people to understand? So I want you to keep, that's point number one. Point number one is the higher education faces some serious challenges. Serious organizational challenges, serious monetary challenges, serious instructional challenges, serious administrative challenges. So part two is I want to talk about libraries. And I want to talk about what, in essence, we can do and why I think there's a model to be looked at in libraries that we can move into a general higher education mode. So we're going to start with the idea that libraries are educational institutions. Right? Proposition. Now, I want to be very clear, because just because you are in an educational institution doesn't make you educational. As an example, I don't think people in the cafeteria go, we're teaching them a lesson. Unless, of course, it's the quality of the food, in which case we're teaching them a very odd lesson. And if you want to give that one, then you must explain to me exactly how the pencil-holding helmet is educational and the auto hat and the beer cozy at a university. This is the message we're sending. That's what we want them to learn. So just because we talk about academic libraries doesn't mean that they are actually educational institutions. In fact, we've sort of, for a long time, stepped back from the notion of being an educational institution. We've sort of pictured ourselves as secondary educational institutions. In other words, we help the people who do the education. Right? We help the professor. We arm the professor. We support the professor when they go into the classroom. They want the papers. They want reserves. They want whatever. That's great. We're there to help. And so when you ask, how at the library have you helped your students? How does the fact that John or Susan gets an A, what part of that does the library own? You get a lot of blank stares. What kind of question is that? What? How would I know? How would I know if that reference question helps them get an A? Is that my job? And now when we look at this movement from output to outcomes, we can't play that game anymore. Right? When we look at how we accredit universities, we used to look at outputs. And they used to say, tell me what a good library is. Well, a good library has this many volumes, circulates this many times, has this much square footage, go. Right? And so we all know about the ARL shuffle. Right? If we want to get up in our wonderful rankings, what we do is we need more volumes. How do we get more volumes? Well, that college down the street happens to just weed half their collection. Let's grab it, put it on our shelves, and we'll go up in the rankings. This is frightening. Right? But that's an output measure. We're good at output measures. We're fantastic at output measures. You want it, we can count it. But that's not what we do anymore, right? It used to be, how good your college? Well, we graduate this many people. Do they know anything? Well, we graduate this many people, right? So we're moving from this idea of outputs to outcomes. Prove that they know something. If they have a degree, what should that degree, what competency should they have? How can they demonstrate it? How can you break back that data? And that doesn't just stop at the classroom. That has to go to all parts of it. All right, library, how were you involved? What was your part? Where did you play? And so just because we're talking about academic libraries does not mean that I automatically assume that we're talking about educational organizations. What makes a library, academic, public, school, special library, what makes them institutions of learning is the mission of their number one asset, which is librarians. The number one asset of any library is not its building, is not its stacks, is not its materials, it's not its circulation, it's not its budget, it's not its endowment, it is its librarians and staff. The people who make that happen. In fact, there is a lie going on throughout this entire lecture, which is that libraries do nothing. Libraries do only two things. They exert gravity and they decay. Right? That's what buildings do. Librarians do things. How many press releases have you put out that says, well, the library did this? Really? Did they commute in that day? Because I don't remember seeing them at 12 o'clock when I was putting that program together. Right? Librarians do this. We hide behind our buildings and our stacks and our programs and say, they'll love us. I know they'll love us. And then we get surprised when they say things like, we don't have the budget, so to keep the hours going, to keep the building open, we're going to fire the librarians and keep the library going because we love the library. And they shoot themselves in the foot. And we set ourselves up for that. There's about stepping up. So, what makes a library an educational organization is the mission of librarians. And that mission, I would put out, is that the mission of librarians is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in their community. Now, there's a lot there, so let me break a few of those things out. First, note that this is the mission of a person, not an institution. And they're two different things. I'm very well aware that when you work in a place, it has an institutional mission. And it's not necessarily the same of everyone who works in that building. I get that. This is the mission of the individual. The second thing is we need to look at knowledge creation. Because knowledge creation is a really important thing. I was just talking with someone the other day, and I was talking about this sort of, as professors do, a useless 30,000-foot argument about the arc of history of librarianship. And the migration of librarianship from a humanities discipline where we talked about truth and philosophy and history to an information discipline where we talk about databases and data and transfer and organization to now, I hope, a learning discipline where we talk about knowledge and how it's incorporated, how we understand and how we learn, which is in some ways back to the humanities side of things. But this notion that how we do knowledge creation, now there's a lot behind that. So I'm going to give you my view of knowledge. And if those philosophers in the room want to have a conversation about epistemology, I'll meet you behind this. Knowledge is created through conversation. In other words, that book is not knowledge. The website's not knowledge. Knowledge is not a commodity, nothing that can be bound. Knowledge is uniquely human. It sits up here. Right? So when you have a book, that's not knowledge. You go, well, but you read it and you get knowledge. Yes, but how does that happen? The book doesn't transfer it to you. Right? And so many of those from the humanities will talk about reading and how reading works. You're having a conversation, not with the author, not with the text, with yourself. Do I agree with it? Do I believe it? A lot of knowledge is having a lot of conversations with yourself. And if you're sitting there asking, what does he mean by that? Who are you asking? This idea that we have conversations, right? Have you ever done this where you're like, you go out in the morning and the bagel place is there, but the good coffee's there? And you do one of these, I'm going to get the bagel. No, I should get the coffee first. No, I really want that bagel. And you're sitting there having a fight with yourself. And if you do that long enough, and if you talk out loud, people will take you away. But that internal dialogue, that internal conversation is where knowledge comes from. It also comes from individuals talking back and forth. What do you know about this? What do you know about that? These kinds of things. So that conversation, that process of interaction, is how we begin to learn. And back to, in David's introduction, the idea that if we are in the knowledge business, we're in the conversation business. Not the stuff business, not the thing business, not the book business, not the database business. The conversation business. And so when we talk about what is our role as librarians, what does the library, Royal Library, do? They facilitate these conversations to improve society. I'm going to skip that one for a second. So how do we facilitate conversations? Well, the first thing is we provide access. All right? So you go, all right, that's great. We've got lots of books. We circulate them. Done. Step back. We provide access to knowledge. Knowledge is uniquely human, developed through conversation. So what you need to do is provide access not simply to artifacts and materials, which are the results of knowledge, but to conversations and people, which are the origins of knowledge. So the idea that when you come in and you say, look, I'm working on topic X, and you've probably all done it at some point where you say, oh, you need to talk to so-and-so. That means so-and-so is part of your collection, not just the book they wrote and not just the thing they left behind. When two people are sitting and discussing, when you're creating rooms where students can come in and study after hours, you're creating the opportunity for creation. When you put a whiteboard so they can sit there and scribble back and forth, you're providing access to each other, to minds, to information. The second thing that we provide is training. So if you think about it, here's this conversation going on. I'm going to talk about archives in a moment. Archive, Cornell put it up, right, where the physics community comes and talks. So we can provide access. Here's the URL. Good luck. By the way, do you know what physics is? No. Right? They're talking about string theory. Do you know what string theory is? What I put in my shoelaces? No. Right? We have to bring people up to speed. It's like handing them a book and saying, here, learn. That's great. It's in Chinese. I don't speak Chinese. That's not going to help me. So we need to provide them and prepare them with basic knowledge to get to the conversation. I would argue that much of education, particularly at the higher education level, is preparing people for the language of interaction even more than it is the content of interaction. These are the terms we use. This is the regularity we use. This is how you understand those terms. This is how we come to define them. And then what we need to do is provide an environment so when they get there, they have access, they know what to say. When they get there, they feel safe having the conversation. We feel safe having conversations. Safe is two. Physical safety. A lot of libraries provide physical safety. It's campus. It's after hours. We're open till midnight. And if you leave, we'll provide you escort back to your car. But we also look at a cornerstone of providing intellectual safety. If you go look into this area, we're not tracking and going to call and tell your mother. Pat Santulli, who's a tech coordinator at a high school, when her son went to college, she made sure that she got her son's login ID so that he could go in and find out if he was using the library. Right? Maybe not providing that level of intellectual safety for her son. Right? What are you doing checking out that book? What's going on? Right? So once you get to it, once you know what to do, you have to feel safe doing it. And finally, motivation, which is, I don't want to. So think about that for a moment. Think about, not that any librarian here has ever gone to a staff meeting before, but you're in a staff meeting. How many of you have encountered the historian? How many of you are willing to admit that you are the historian? The historian is the person that whenever you come up with a new idea, they raise their hand and they invariably will begin the sentence with, what you have to remember is. I would like to start a Twitter stream for the library. What you have to remember is, we tried this in 1938, and it didn't work. Twitter, yes, it was with pigeons, and there was tying, and it was just a mess, right? What happens is, you're at the meeting, you know what's going on, and that person has just blown the environment because they just said to you, you don't know enough to participate. And eventually, why will I bother? We look at, someone talked about zombie librarians, and it wasn't from the idea of, you know, it's a great new AMC thing. It was the idea that we have some librarians that have frankly died in the job and kept working, right? Statistical abstract. I use the Eric Thesaurus in paper. We have a demotivating environment for ourselves as well as for those we serve. So when we look at these means of facilitation, how do they turn out? So access, the idea of archive versus what we've been putting up as institutional repositories. Institutional repositories are supposed to be the white knight that would save academic libraries. Instead of them giving them to those evil database people, they'll send them to us and we'll put them in the line and that will change the world. And in fact, what we created were digital morgues where papers go to die. Right? It was just the stuff from your professor, which they weren't going to look up because they wrote it. It wasn't in a journal form, so you had no idea if it was peer-reviewed or useful, much less be able to find it because it was hidden behind Google. And so we created these nice silos. Compare that to something like the Public Library of Science or Archive, where what you're doing is you're seeing a conversation go on. Joan Bechtel in the 80s said the essence of academic librarianship is scholarly communication. The number one thing we need to teach as our curriculum is scholarly communication. That when this professor publishes, it's not just to get tenure. But it's not supposed to be just to get tenure. Right? It's supposed to advance the discussion. It's supposed to go to peers. Peers comment. They take that data. They try that data. That idea of what's in these stacks, what's on these books, is really the academy talking to itself and talking about advancement. Right? So when you think about what systems are you setting up and what conversations are you allowing? We were talking before about digital humanities projects. How much of them turn into beautiful art pieces on the web and how many of them are truly provoking conversation and discussion? How many of them allow you to say, that's an interesting perspective, have you taken this perspective, have you seen this perspective, have you seen that one? Where we look at conversations. Libraries have a really unique and amazing thing that they can do on most college campuses, which is they span disciplines. So I can't talk to you because I'm in information science, and we don't trust the communication people because they want to steal social media from us. And I'm in communications, and I can't talk to the information people because they want to steal social media from us. But, you know, right? Meanwhile, the librarian's answering both the questions going, hello? I did this study. MacArthur asked me to come up with what is the future of libraries. It's fine, by the way. And so I called all these public library directors, and I said, what is the future of libraries? And they would always start with, well, I can't tell you about academic libraries because they're screwed. But for public libraries, it's an educational space where people can collaborate. And I call up a director of an academic library, and they say, well, I can't tell you about public libraries because they're screwed. But for us, it's as an interesting conversational interactive space where people can collaborate. I was just like, could you please for a moment just have a conversation? Right? We tend, you know, academia has one ruling algorithm, which is divide pond until biggest fish within IM. Right? So I don't just do library work, I do reference work. I do reference work, I do virtual reference work. I do virtual reference, I do real-time virtual work. Right? So I study this molecule on Thursday. That's my job, and I'm really good at it. Right? So how do we provide access to conversation? And in training and knowledge, concierge librarian, I love this idea. That when you first come in and you're an undergraduate and you're going, yay, beer, yay, right? You can sit them down and go, and this is how you have to actually not get kicked out. And this is what classes you have to go into. This is what a bursar is. Because I didn't know what a bursar was other than it ruined my life on many an occasion, right? And so how do we then walk them through? And I love this one. Rather than teaching bibliographic instruction, we need to teach things like how to hack college. For the information people, we deal with systems and flows and everything else. We should be able to teach our students how to get in there and manipulate and work these systems, understand these systems, use these systems. Not just library systems, but all systems. And the idea of creating maker spaces and incubators in an academic library environment. Because some of the training we do is not, once again, me standing in front of you going, this good, this bad. Or, I'm going to teach you how to use this system. Click here, now click here, now click here. Why? Don't ask. Click here, now why? Right? But to say, how can they do it themselves? How can they learn? I was in public library example, forgive me, but I was in a workshop where they were making what they call bristlebots. Now a bristlebot, in case you're wondering, is the top end of a toothbrush, the bristles. They cut off the ends, right? And you put on it a small watch battery and the what's called the mechanism that makes old pagers vibrate. It's actually just a thing that spins, right? And what happens is when you hook up the spinning vibrator to the battery on top of the bristlebot, it moves. And you can race them, and this is very exciting. Well, and this is supposed to be very exciting for whom? Teenagers and preteens who never come to the library, so this is going to do it. This is it, right? So I bring my dutifully bring my sons in, and we're all bristle-botting, and what happens is it turns out those darn little vibrating things take a lot of juice. And if you buy the wrong batteries, it goes and dies. Like that fast. Now, so what happens is there are like four librarians. They're all proud because they're in a makerspace. And they're teaching them how to like duct tape things on. And it goes, zzz, and the kids just start getting bored. And I swear, all four librarians went to a corner and they're like a huddle going, they're going to get us. We've got to figure something out now. Now, while they're huddling, figuring out how to rearrange their pedagogical activities, the kids are sitting there going, you got a AAA? Yeah. Why do we cut this off? Hey, look, I can make a bristle tank. And they're sitting there with duct tape, and they got like five toothbrushes, and like if they could have, they would have gone in the parking lot and pulled out my battery, I swear to God, because they had these things moving, and suddenly, to watch the librarian suddenly went, bing. That's what a makerspace is. That's what true authentic learning is. The fact that I don't know something as a librarian is okay. How many times, that as a faculty member, I will admit to this, but as a librarian, we won't teach something until we know it perfectly, until we have every screen memorized. The idea of walking in front of a carnivorous group of undergraduates and showing fear, right, is dangerous and anathema to us. But the truth is, they know stuff that we don't. And by the way, it's not technology writ large. I have plenty of people that know how to use phones just right, but they have no idea what a cell tower is, and they have no idea when texting, what SMS as a protocol is, and all this other stuff. They're great users, but they don't necessarily understand the depth of why things work. Imagine putting that together. Imagine coming in and saying, this is how the library systems work, but then going, comma, How should they work? How do you use them? What's going on here? And then learning together how to make a better system. In environment, we have to talk about going to the conversation. So we talk about the idea of embedded librarians, not just an office hour where we spend an hour at the chemistry department and hope someone stops by, but spending time going, knock on doors. Hi, I noticed that you're working on this project. Can I help? I've seen this article, et cetera. My favorite thing is tenure. I had a friend who was going up for tenure, and I said, call the library. Because what he had to do was a citation now. Call the library. And the librarian said, I can give you an hour. Either you or your graduate assistant can come down, and I can teach you how to do a citation search. I said, all right. So what they've just said is, one, the future of your career is worth an hour. And two, everything to know about citation analysis can be taught in an hour. What is the core of what we teach librarians in terms of metadata, manipulation? An hour? Really? We could save some time in our master's program. Imagine instead you know who's going up for tenure. And so someone comes up for tenure, the first day they're in their office, you go, my name's Dave, I'll be your tenure librarian. Good to meet you. What I've done is I've gone ahead and run Scopus and Web, and by the way, this is Google Scholar. If you looked at the alt metrics, because alt metrics is interesting. And you help them throughout. Here's the great thing. They get tenure. You are the most wonderful human being. I guarantee chocolate. I guarantee big bags of it and baskets of it. And if they don't get tenure, they leave before they can badmouth you. This is even better. But we give them an hour. And Twitter reference, I love this one. Twitter reference is what we're now moving to in 5.11, where Lankus gets up and spouts off, and then every time, and the students sit there and tweet on a hashtag going, Lankus just said this, Lankus just said that. And there's a librarian standing by on the Twitter feed that will then go back, what he meant was, what he should have said was, well, that's just complete garbage. Anyway, the idea of doing in-classroom reference work. You know, I'll sit to a point and I'll go, oh, what was, tweet that out. And there's a librarian sitting on the other end waiting to help. We talk about being invited into classrooms. We don't have to be physically there. We don't necessarily even have to be on the lesson plan. And online is ascendant. We know that people live in virtual worlds. If there's anything that librarians know, we can have the analog versus digital fits all we want, but we know that we live in a digital age. We know that it's impossible to do it all on paper anymore. It's impossible to do some things without paper. I grant you that. But we know what it is to be online. And in terms of motivation, we have this brilliant thing that when people come into the library, now, grant you, we'll get the papers due tomorrow. Do you have the answer for me? But we have the ability to have people come in and say, I'm really interested in snakes. Let's go with that. How do we go and learn about that? Be inquiry-driven so we don't have to force them to learn something we want. So what does a learning-based library look like? A learning-based library is all about conversation. The collection is the community, not the books, not the artifacts, not the materials. They're important, but they're tools. Over the decades, we lost focus. We thought we were there to take care of the stuff. The stuff was there to take care of us, right? It's a tool to us to use. Where do we use it? How do we use it? How do we get forward? We spent so much time worrying about how to organize it and move it and digitize it and push it and co-locate it and order that we forgot the reason we were doing that is so people could learn from it. And just because you make it browsable doesn't make it useful. So, conversations are about participation. You cannot be in a conversation where there's not another voice. Else, it's a monologue. I'm good at those, right? But it's not a conversation. And participation is about co-ownership. If a group of students walks in and says, we have a manga club. We love Japanese comics. We have 500 of them and no place to put them. Can I keep them in your library? You sit there and go, well, no. Or how would we catalog them all? Or are they already covered in plastic? You know? Why not say, there. Well, what happens if someone steals them? You tell them, by the way, someone could steal them. What happens if they put them out of the order? You might want to say, you know, you might want to stop by every so often and put them back in order. Trust them. It's their materials. They can own that process as well. Right? So we have to think about this idea of working with our students and our faculty. So, point number one, higher ed is in trouble. Point number two, libraries are about learning. how can we use the idea of our new idea and understanding of libraries to help higher education that's in trouble? Problem number one. The model of higher education today is what I call a commencement model. A commencement model means we get you ready for a career or life. The idea is you're 18. Come in, we'll screw with your head for 4 years, spit you out, and you'll be an engineer or chemist or what have you. And then at some point, you'll get out of date, or you'll move to administration, or you'll want to change jobs. No problem. Come back. More debt. Yay. And we'll give you another degree, and it's called a master's degree. All right. That one's worn out. No problem. Have you seen our doctorate offers recently? All right? And we keep walking them through, preparing them at the beginning of their career. I've said this out loud. The notion that I can prepare a librarian 2.5 years at the beginning of their career for the next 40 years of their career is absurd. Right? So when you get that fabled director spot, you sit there and go, budgeting. I remember that. 40 years ago, it involved math. Right? So this is the commencement model. We bring them in and we get them ready at the beginning. And then it's great because when we send them out, they're alumni. So what do? We ask them for money. Right? Well, we've already talked about what about continuing education? And some fields have picked this up. Education. You get an education degree, you're going to come back and do workshops and constantly get refreshed. Barbers. Barbers have to be certified and get continuous training to be a barber. Librarians? Not so much. Barbers. But I want to talk about taking it one step more, which is to the idea of continuous education. So we'll take you when you're 18, and we're going to worry about you until you retire. But in that time, when you go through your work life, when you go through working and figuring out, understanding, appreciating art, I love the fact that I took an English class when I was 18. I didn't have the world experience to understand the stuff I was reading. Now imagine going back and looking at that going, good Lord, that's what they were trying to say. Right? There are some people I'll never understand what they were trying to say. But anyway, and what we can do with continuous education is create a cycle where there's constant connection, where there's a connection ongoing, that instead of thinking about it as paid for a degree and then you're an alumni, think of it as subscribing to an institution that's continuously learning. And it's not just a matter of, great, now we can charge the money for a long time. It's a fundamental shift where we need to move the idea from an alum to a member, where we look at the idea where students are not just consumers. I hate the word consumer. Hate it, hate it, hate it, hate it. I mean, I don't, in fact, if you're buying a truck, you're consuming it. But instead of saying we have patrons, now we have consumers, no, you don't. Students, now they're customers, no, they're not. Think about the relationship between a student and their alma mater. In the first 5 years, say, of their profession, they get reputation from the alma mater. We grant them reputation. Ooh, you guys from Hamilton? Come on in. But in the next 20, 30 years of their careers, they give the reputation back to the institution. Look who graduated from here. That's not a customer-consumer model. It's muddled. So we have to, first of all, get rid of the idea that students are these wonderful empty buckets in the field, and that I, as a faculty, are throwing bricks of knowledge into the buckets. And if they fail, that means the bucket was a little too small. Because those bricks were perfect. And the idea that teachers are producers, so we have to know everything. This idea that somehow we know everything, it's the schizophrenia. Because I'm a researcher. The fundamental tenet of being a researcher is you don't know anything, right? It's like someone once said, you get a middle school degree, your knowledge is good for about 100 years. You get a high school degree, it's good for about 50 years. Chemistry doesn't change that fast. You get an undergraduate, you're down to about 10. Master's, you're down to about 2. PhD is actually irrelevant when you enroll, right? We continuously learn. We need to bring that into our classroom. We need to have our students do it. We need to think about participants shaping the learning environment that we're in, and we need to think about this idea of a sort of expertise economy. What do I mean by that? I mean the idea here is that maybe today you're the student, but you know more about this piece of technology. You should teach this part of the class. We have undergraduates at 18 who come in that know more about a given technology, in our case, than anyone else. They should teach that part of the class, and I should sit as a professor and listen. And when they graduate, not only should they come back to us to take courses, we should tap on them to teach courses and mentor. And we do that with our alums, but it's just like a nice thing. It should be a part of the ecosystem. We also need to think about moving away from a focus, or move to a focus of accrediting knowledge and out of a monopoly of delivery. What that means is, right now, today, the certification, the accreditation of knowledge, and the delivery are seen as bundled. You go to college to learn. But as a good Jeffrey Katzer, a good mentor of mine once said, you don't pay me to teach, you pay me to grade. Meaning, I need to not only give you the instruction, but I need to certify that you know it. That's what that paper supposedly means. And we bundle them. We say, oh, you go to college to get both of those things. And we sit there and say, well, that's the way it always is, right? You can't unbundle these things. I want to give you a tech example of how that reasoning doesn't always work. IBM was in the computer business. They built computers. And they got to a group called Microsoft, and they said, you two young punks, make an operating system for this piddly thing called a PC. And the Microsoft people, Bill Gates, Paul Allen, said, okay, but we get to own the software. And IBM said, sure. It's a computer, right? In their mind, operating system, hardware, plug, consulting services, Salesforce, that was computing. It was one big monolithic bunch. But Microsoft said, I bet I can just find a whole market just in operating systems. And they did, right? So what they did was they said, IBM defines this monolith. If we go and redefine it and segment it, we can own this segment and we can grow. And they did. And then this other little upstart went to Microsoft called Netscape. Many of you don't remember it. And they said, hey, this internet thing's kind of cool. Now, you may not remember, but at the time, Bill Gates famously got up and said, the internet is a great little delivery mechanism, but that's about all it will be. The browser, no one uses a browser. They might save somewhere, right? And so Netscape said, look, an operating system consists of controlling the hardware and browsing the internet. And they said, we'll take that segment, and they blew it up. And then this other little two crazy kids in a garage came up and said, hey, search is where it's at. And Netscape, doing just fine on its IPO, said, search, that's just a website. It's the software to get you there. Right? How many people use Chrome, and then you use Safari, and then you use Firefox, and then you use Mozilla because they, right? You go through 50 browsers a day, and you don't even pay attention. Right? Everything's a browser now. Every app on it. Angry Birds is a browser on the internet because it sends your score somewhere. Right? So this idea of, oh, don't worry, we're in college education. When I started the MOOC thing, they can't take the teaching part out of the university. It's so integral to research. But we've seen it already. I don't know about Hamilton, but at Syracuse, we have Ernie Davis Hall. It's on the campus. It's named after a football player. It serves food. There are students who stay there, but it's a dormitory that Syracuse does not own. It's a privately run institution. We've already outsourced food. Let's face it, we've done a really good job outsourcing most of sports. Right? This idea that somehow we can't take this big block and break it down, it's going like crazy around us. And so instead of thinking about we've got to own it all, what if we thought about the idea of, you know what we could create? A personal education record. This is the idea of a personal health record. I'm very familiar with this concept. Over this past year, if you're ever a cancer patient, you have filled out so many times, what is your date of birth? What is your social security number? What medication do you take? It's like, don't you people have a Xerox? You know? But so the idea is we could create a personal health record. And just someone asks, hey, could I have that? Yeah. You ever fill out that form and they say, this is the HIPAA form? Right? And then they spend all the time telling you about how they can't share your information. They won't give their information. Does anyone know what the P in HIPAA stands for? Portability. A lot of people think it's privacy. It is not. The HIPAA law was passed to get away from the idea that every doctor had their own stovepipe and make a record that could be moved seamlessly throughout. But then the lawyers got involved and they put a bunch of, you know, privacy things on it, and so it's become a way of keeping information from me. But I have a doctoral student who's looking at the idea of a personal health information. Anyone have one of these things? This is my Fitbit, right? Or an up, right? So, you know, because it's important I know how many stairs I went up.
Are you ever at the point where you actually take an extra flight of stairs just to get that extra point? That's right. I found out that if I go on the riding mower, it counts as a step. That's right. My wife's looking at me going, jeez, you did a lot of walking today. Yes, I did. Put it on the dog. I like that one even better. Right? Well, imagine if this information went here as well. So your doctor asks, are you working out? Oh, yes, I am. Well, you're not so much. Right? This phone will take my pulse rate. Right? Through the flash and the camera, you hold your finger up to it, it will give you your pulse rate on it. Can that go in there? What happens when we're walking around and we're constantly collecting information? This idea of creating a personal health record. Now, take that idea and put it over to the idea of a personal education record. And so what we do is we have our students sitting out there, and the student says, gee, here's a really interesting online webinar. Gee, if I sit through listening to Lankus blather on for an hour, I can pretend I know about topic X. Right? Do this all the time. Right? You've gone through professional development of one form, you go through an online lecture, you go through a webinar, or better yet, we send librarians to conferences. This is continuing education. What did you do? I went to the bar. And it was in Chicago, so I had to see the architectural tour. Right? And how do you pick the sessions you go to? That one looks interesting. Ooh, that's fun. This friend, ooh, I hate them. Right? What does it align, what sessions you went to at the conference, how does it align to your learning objectives? How do those learning objectives apply to your position? How does that apply to certification, et cetera, et cetera? So imagine you take this webinar and you say, I took a webinar in accounting. Going back to your alma mater, your partner institution, and saying, I now know accounting, certified. Maybe this was a course at Syracuse, maybe it was a course at Hamilton, maybe it was a course by J.P. Morgan Chase. And they certify it, and it goes into your personal education record. Really interesting idea about medical records, the difference between ownership and guardianship. You own all of your medical health records, but you're not allowed to change them. So the guardianship of your health records is with your doctor, with the institution, right? So the idea is that your alma mater has guardianship of this. You can tell them who to share it with and whenever, but you're not allowed to go in and say, now I know this, and now I know that. So where does the trust come in? From the employer, it comes from there. Right? And so now you go and you take a Hamilton College course, or you get Microsoft certified, or whatever. Wherever you're getting this education, you can constantly have this relationship with an institution to say, I know this, I know this, I know this. Certify, accredit. And how does that happen? Well, it happens because we have a faculty. I'd like to think we still have faculty. I'd like to have a job. But it also happens from this distributed pool of expertise I mentioned before, including our alums. If you know accounting, maybe we'll go to the accounting professor. Don't have an accounting professor, maybe we'll go to the guy who works at the bank or whatever that has that kind of credential. And we build this marketplace of expertise. So how does this work in librarianship? Well, first of all, we're talking about sort of, well, let's do it this way. An alum to a member is like we talk about in librarianship, moving from the idea of patron to a member. Moving from someone we serve to someone who co-owns the library and the information. Moving from alum, someone we graduated and asked for money, to someone who takes our courses, who teaches our courses, who works with. We have library science students that know brilliant things. They come back from internships, from digital humanities projects. They should be teaching the other students at the same time and get credit for it and get money for it would be nice too. Right? Moving from credits to outcomes, moving from artifacts to learning. Instead of saying, does anyone know where 3 credits comes from, by the way? The 3-credit course? It was a labor management. It was, how do I pay for this? It was never about how much content fits into something. And now we live in this tyranny of 3 credits. I would like to teach 1.28 credits worth of information, please. Well, I don't think we have that in. We don't have decimals. We can't do that. The bursar won't let us. The registrar won't let us do a course in the summer that did. Right? We need to get out of that business. We need to move into the idea of what do you know and how do you know it? We need to move away. And one of my favorite things is Empire College. Empire College in New York State, where you can go and say, you know, I've been an engineer. Give me some credit for what I know. I'll prove it. Why can't we do that here? Right? The idea of moving from managing courses to managing documents, that the idea that a course was somehow separate, Right? So we wanted to get their documents. What we do is we wait for that, you know, esteemed professor to die, and then we raid their room and grab every document we could. Right? But their courses are gone. Their teaching, their lectures, their ideas, gone. My favorite is a teacher comes to you and says, I'm teaching this course, here's the syllabus. What that syllabus represents is not only the material that he or she feels is relevant, but the order in which they feel it's relevant, the connection to topic they feel is relevant. There's a huge amount of information context in that syllabus. What do? We rip out the to read section, we put them on reserve in alphabetical order and say, thank you. How can we capture that learning, that knowledge, that dynamism? How can we stop thinking about documents? How can we stop thinking about courses? And this idea from classroom to online, where Harvard has now discovered online education, so it must be interesting. We live this world. We're living this world now. As faculty members, I've been teaching online for 20 years. Right? I get people go, how in the world do you teach that? How do you? Oh, there's some things you could never teach online. We started that way. I don't know if I have any. I know you're in our distance program. I don't know if anyone else has survived our distance program. Were you there the days when we brought you in for like this three-week period where you basically took all your courses for a semester, and then we'd send you home and like there'd be one reading due because all the faculty had no idea how to teach via email. So we did it all in 2 weeks. Right? We don't do that anymore. Hopefully we teach more. But anyway, all right, so now you come for a week, and then you never have to come back to campus. Congratulations. Right? We learned how to do it, but we started with, oh, you can't teach reference online. You can't teach reference. Why not? Well, you can't do reference online. Why not? Because you can't, like, look at them. What do you mean you can't look at them? Someone once said, the reference interview is putting a patron on the rack until they tell you the truth. Right? So Dave comes in and goes, I need a book on nutrition. Right? Well, what kind of book on nutrition? You know, and eventually you like convince them by telling them a pure question. Look, I'm fat and I need a diet, right? This book's this one. Well, you can't do that online. You can't teach this online. I've seen some brilliant teaching of feminist philosophy online, teaching of literature and appreciation online. There's amazing stuff going on. And we're increasingly living in an online world. And we know the pain. We know the pain. When it's online, how do you capture it? How do you remember it? How do you do version control? How do you store it over the long term? How do you find it? Et cetera, et cetera. We know how to do that. Right now, they're going, I put it on my MOOC. Good luck. Right? Oh, where are your lectures, Dave Lankus, for this MOOC? It's on Vimeo.com. Will it be there forever? Yeah? Maybe? How would we ensure? Is that important? We've had these discussions. We need to bring this in. So higher ed needs to be like libraries, but not libraries focused on collections, not libraries of things and organizations. Higher ed needs to be like libraries, but not functionally oriented libraries where librarians define themselves by what they do and not why they do it. Why are you a librarian? Because I organize stuff. Why do you organize stuff? Because I'm a librarian. That's circular logic, folks. You do it because someone's going to get better. Better at being a student, better at being a professor, improving our lives, coming up with a new discovery, or simply more content in who they are. Not information-based libraries. They need to be more like progressive libraries that see learning, participation, and community as the core of what they do. Higher education desperately needs libraries, but they need our innovation more than I need our collections. I've seen too many librarians in academia that step back and look at the end of libraries coming down. They're waiting for them. They're just praying their retirement 401k kicks in before someone discovers what Google could really do. Zombie librarians, right? They need us. But the fear that we get is because, oh, everything's becoming digital and, oh, it's easier to find it online. That's a good thing. That's a good thing, but they need our innovation, they need our struggles, they need our fights. The fights that we had around intellectual property, archiving, the ability to create records and documents over time, the ability to create metadata and the organization of metadata is essential to today's and tomorrow's online, distributed, crazy university. And there's no one better prepared than librarians to lead that way. Close the building, burn the books, keep the librarians. We were looking at a large, in Boston, I think it was Exeter, large boarding school was in the Boston Globe, got rid of their library, got rid of all the books. I was talking to the headmaster, he said, no. Kept all the fiction. All the nonfiction was out of date, and I had a choice of either buying a lot of out-of-date stuff, buying new ones physically, or buying digital. This was not a hard decision for me. So they got rid of it. It turns out they had a lot more room for students to come in and study, collaborate, work together. And you know what? Now they need to hire more librarians. Want to know why? Because what happens is the students can now use 24-hour access to all the stuff that raises questions that they need help on, which they need a librarian to help them with. So what he needs to do is hire 24/7 librarian service for his students. We think we're doing our students a service by opening up late into the night and staffing it with our least capable people because, oh, it's a place they can be. That's true. But is that the value we want to present? Is that the face that we want to present? The power of libraries comes from librarians. The power of librarians comes from our commitment, our purpose, and our skills, and our values around learning and knowledge. If you're a librarian because you love books, that's fine. But you're a librarian to help someone be better, to improve society one student at a time. That's what we're about learning. That's how higher education can learn from libraries. Not, oh, this is how the space goes and this is where the stuff goes. They need our innovation more than they need our collections. That's where we should be focused on. All right. Them's my prepared talks. Questions, comments, where did I get it completely wrong? Yes. Okay. My definition of librarian is broader than most. I think there are three ways to become a librarian. I think one, you get a degree in it. Two, you get a job in it. And three, you're born with the soul of one. Now, I know that sounds really flippant, but let me make that real. Real is a good library science degree is very important. It's a quick way to get into the knowledge, the profession, the background, the history, and the philosophy of the field. In 2 years, I think it's what you need to crystallize that knowledge. I think it takes longer, but it's quite possible to get it by being hired as a librarian or hired in the library, and I have what I call a hit-by-the-bus definition, which is if you get hit by a bus and the major functions of the library will stop, you're a librarian, right? I get this all the time. Oh, I'm in IT. What do? I make sure that the catalog runs. What happens if you get hit by a bus? The catalog doesn't run. You're a librarian. The third is what I call the soul of a librarian, and that is someone who really does understand the passion for learning, plus the ways and values of information safety, the idea of information freedom, these kinds of things. So it is a broad definition. I don't think it's simply someone with MLS after that. I personally teach in an MLS program because I think it's one of the most efficient ways to become that. Fair enough? Questions, thoughts, disagreements? We have minutes. You do. You seriously have this. This is, as I was reminded, this is how I teach all my classes because I'm addicted to mints. And my fellow here, who had to live through my class, brought mints for everyone. So take and pass them around. See, it's friendly kindness.
Oh, God, flashbacks.
Flashbacks, I know. All right. I don't know if we have any chat questions as well. I know you're looking at that. I've stunned everyone. They fell asleep a week ago. Okay. I've not done a TED Talk. My mother did want to understand how an Episcopalian from Ohio became a Southern preacher, but no, not yet.
Ohio.
It's Ohio, that's right.
Are you familiar with Just-in-Time Learning by
Papert? I'm familiar with a lot of Papert's work in general, but not necessarily specifically on that one. I mean, constructivism and constructionism, I think, has a lot to go here, So I have a friend online, Lane Wilkinson, who is a reference librarian and a philosopher. And so he and I go back regularly on the notion of constructionism and objectivism and all these other things. But I think we both agree that pedagogically, the idea of people constructing and being active learners is sort of fundamental to what we need to do. We can argue about what is truth later, but we agree that we'll find it that way.
The biggest problem that we have is that things have come in from famous writers and other education and all the people. And it would take an enormous amount of funding to digitize that. So the collection is still the most valuable if people actually visit the library. Do you have any rules on it, how to get people know about the heart of some material if they're going to have to come and visit?
All right, so first I have to give my defensive answer, and then I'll actually make sure I get to the real one. So the defensive one is when I give this speech, it's normally, oh, Dave's a digital one, burn all the books. I heard that, right? The story I tell is of a man who was doing investigations of ancient texts, and he was walking through, like, all of the British basements of their libraries and special collections, and he'd be looking through the text. And it was this gentleman sitting, and he had horrible hay fever. And there was a gentleman sitting next to him who would sort through some papers, and then every so often go, put it down. Sort through it. And this guy's just going nuts. Finally, he said, what are you doing? He said, I'm tracing the Black Plague's progress through England. He said, by trying to get it? I mean, he said, no. He says, this is what happens. He said, at the time this was happening, trade was essential to these small villages. If people didn't come in or out or buy stuff, the village would die. So the last thing you ever wanted to do was say, hey, the plague's here, because then people wouldn't come. So if you're writing a letter to your friends and neighbors to invite them in to buy stuff, what are you going to say? Great here. No plague. Haven't seen plague for a while. They take all the letters, throw them into a mail pouch, and douse them in vinegar to kill the plague and then deliver them. So what he was doing was not reading the text, because that didn't tell him anything, but smelling for vinegar so he could track where the plague was. That's a long way of saying there is an essential nature to the physicalness of things. I don't think that you can replace everything with a digital copy. All right, so that was my self-defensive answer. The larger question about how do you get people in, I think particularly in an educational environment, is you make it integral to the educational experience. That I know we've built lots of special collections by old alumni and what they'll provide and things of that nature, but for example, my library science students fall in love and spend a lot of time in our special collections because they go once, and Ken Lavender walks them through, this was Elizabeth I's diary. This is the first, you know, Charles Darwin version, and they fall in love with that. And because it's part of a class where they became experienced, they understand it, they then want to see what's available. And then it becomes important that if they want to see it's available, you can't put up a big stop sign before they walk in the building. Philadelphia Free Library has an amazing collection. They have the crow, stuffed crow that apparently was the raven, right, inspired there. They have beautiful prints. And I went up to see this. And the way you do it is you take an elevator up to the fifth floor and you walk up to a massive iron gate and you ring a bell with a sign saying, ring bell, please be prepared to wait up to 20 minutes. After 20 minutes, someone walks in, pulls them up, and then asks why you're there, and then will show you just the one thing you need. This does not stimulate discourse and conversation. So the idea of having that integrated into a curriculum, and we talk a lot about reference librarians going out and talking to teachers. We talk a lot about special collections or not special. We talk about reserves and interlibrary loan. But how much time does special collections spent directly with a faculty member going, just like the slide library, you know, we also have materials that may be useful and interesting in bringing that back in. I don't have a specific solution other than the more integrated it is to ongoing compelling conversations, in this case, teaching environments, the more utility people are going to find and the more they're going to use something. Yes.
I've always thought that if you have your head where the outcomes are, that's what you're thinking. The outputs happen.
Right.
They fall into line.
Right.
They're there and they increase and all
right.
The things that you have to use to evaluate and measure
right.
happen on their own.
I was at a meeting where we're talking virtual reference stuff, and this is in 98, 99. And the way you got people interested in virtual reference is you scared the hell out of them. I don't know if any of you played this game. So you would bring up these ARL statistics of reference questions in academic libraries, and it was this nice, light decline. Right? Actually, it wasn't so slight. Right? And look, reference is dying. If we don't go online, we will die with it. This gentleman stands up and goes, I am the director of an academic library. My librarians have asked me, and I've done my best to support through budget, better websites, better instructions, better tutorials. They've asked for more and more resources. I look at that graph and I see success. Right? In other words, if I do a good job in website and training, they'll ask less questions. You can argue that or not. But the idea being, if your head is around, we want more questions, we want more output, then that's what you'll count whether it's useful or not. But you're right.
if your head's around outcomes, the output should follow. And one of the big issues we have in ARL statistics is they haven't yet. We're still looking at volume counts. We're still looking at these things that don't help us.
Yeah. All of that kind of stuff. But those will happen.
Yeah. I talked to a school librarian. You know what's bumping up her circulation statistics right now? She loans out power adapters for iPads and iPhones. Number one circulating item. Right? But it's an example of, because I want to support them using these devices, that's what I'm going to circulate. Turns out that's that output, that number will also escalate, and it is an indication that I want to show.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes? It's a nice arc because a lot of my research career started in reference. And I remember Linda Smith wrote, literally Bopet Smith, the book on reference, standing up in a meeting going, I don't know what to teach in my reference class anymore. And it was like this sort of watershed moment of, you know, it's like Moses going, I didn't know if there should be 10 or 11 of those commandments, right? So we used to teach genre. Or as I call it, the scavenger hunt version of reference. Here's an impossible reference question. Good luck, right? We've moved away from genre and increasingly are looking at one interpersonal interaction because it's valuable not only in the reference transaction, but it turns out when talking to human beings in general. And the other is instruction. That really looking at the reference encounter, Marie Radford's great work on reference encounter, as an instructional moment and not simply a information fulfillment request. Too many times the reference interaction is get them to an item and walk away. Right? It's like, so literally last week, my student comes in, we sent them, they were sent out to all the libraries to sort of see how they did interaction. And they came back and said, this reference librarian asked what I want, and so I was sort of on the spot. I said, I need information about Christopher Columbus. And so the reference librarian, academic Syracuse University Library, went, did a search on Christopher Columbus, handed her the first item that showed up with a call number and said, that should help. Didn't even have time to even read what it was, right? But that's okay. That reference transaction's over. As opposed to, what do you want, what do you need? Now, here's where it gets interesting, is if you think of reference as an instructional process, where you still need to know genre, you still need to know how to search and find. But if you think of it as instructional, then you go back to the nature of instruction, conversation, construction, etc. We need to start thinking much more social about reference. I don't just mean we're on social media answering Twitter questions. I mean social as in, hey, does anyone else have the answer? What else? How do we know this? How do we figure it out? The idea of bringing multiple people into that. One of the things that we used to face was the greedy librarian problem. The greedy librarian problem was that reference librarians never want to admit failure. So they will take a reference question and they will answer it to death. You know, it's like, I have no clue, but I'm going to go get a PhD in this topic so I can come back in 5 years and answer this question. Meanwhile, don't ask anyone else until I'm back. Right? This greedy librarian problem was, but it might be much easier to shift and move and share and see it. So looking at it as more social and more instruction. And so when we talk about teaching, our reference class is now reference and instruction as a class. Mm-hmm. Right. And what I actually like the idea of tiered reference services, because we were just joking at the start of this, that the number one reference question is no longer where's the bathroom, it's have you found a thumb drive, right? That you don't need a huge qualification to answer that question. So being able to take some of the directional questions, the low-end questions, the policy questions, and triage those ahead of time, and then bringing the librarian, who's busy not sitting in their desk with a closed door, but is busy sitting in a department or doing liaison work or working on a production project, to come in and answer that question. And then what I find really interesting is taking the outcome of that process and remembering it. Because reference... it was rather put rather cruelly at one point, but the idea was that reference data was garbage data, because we do with it what we do with garbage. We take an answer and we throw it into the ether and it disappears. Now, some of us have the brain box. I think we have the electronic version, but it's that hard question that we keep under the desk. How do we keep these over time? And then it gets really interesting, which is, wouldn't it be, so we were talking to law librarians, wouldn't it be interesting to know the cases that were being cited by their lawyers and be able to look at that and say, there's a clear bias, there's a clear skew here, there's a clear missing point here, and can we learn from the questions that students are asking, and faculty, but students are asking, can we learn about gaps in curriculum? Can we learn about gaps in preparation instruction? So it becomes part of the main process and not this nice add-on to the top. I think it can be. I mean, I think the social, what I've learned about social networks is they're a vital tool. They're a vital tool, and I won't go into too much detail for everyone's sake, but they're a vital tool because they allow communities to form and use their own language and their own norms and their own culture. In other words, if you're a Facebook user, not every Facebook user is the same. They don't all use the same words. They can build a community there. Same with LinkedIn. So, one, I think it's a valuable tool for us to look at building communities. And I think LinkedIn is one. Facebook's another. I think rather than us creating the Hamilton book, you know, and where everyone felt they had to create their own, or better yet, take the catalog and throw something social on it, that's not the right way to go. Much better to go to where our alums and members are and build those networks where they're already willing to share and create the information. I think it's a great idea. Do we have a question online? No. They tuned out. They're all eating. I turned it back over. Thank you all very, very much. I appreciate the time.